December. Well, I want to discuss in this session, and thank you for attending, I appreciate it, what I think is the most important variable to determine success for clients, the mastery of regulating states of mind. I want to present a couple of vignettes of cases to illustrate ways of working with clients. First, let's look at understanding states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines both how we perceive and process information as well as how we respond. A state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. A key element of mentor coaching is helping a client become aware of various states of mind with particular focus on what state works best for which purpose. And clients can move from a state of mind where they feel stuck or myopic to possibilities, to a state where the scope and range of thinking and possibilities is much broader. Let me give you just a fundamental example of what a state of mind is and how it works. If you take a rat and put it in a maze, and you can teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, you take another rat, put it in the maze, and just a little bit of amphetamine, just a little bit of a stress state. Teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you take away that amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. It can literally, in that maze, die of starvation, even though it has in a part of its brain the awareness of how to get to the cheese, but it can't access it. Now, re-inject the amphetamine, and it immediately goes to the cheese. State-dependent learning and state-dependent memory. So this is an example of two distinct states of mind without any overlap. It's really an example of extreme stress that in humans would be more like post-traumatic stress disorder, where an entire event may not be remembered, or in multiple personality disorder, where distinct states can exist without a seamless blending of moving from one state to another that we usually experience in our ordinary lives. A more common example of what's in our daily life is when we try to think of somebody's name and can't, although we know it's on the tip of our tongue, but just can't quite recall it. Then later, in a more relaxed state of mind, the name comes easily with different states of mind. Now, most of you already know way more about me than you ever wanted to know, but here's a little more. My favorite time of writing is with a cigar and a single malt scotch in a rocking chair on the front porch of my ranch overlooking the lake, a lake in the late quiet of the day. Now, I use a digital recorder to have conversations with an imagined audience or with particular colleagues. I've even had conversations with some of you. That's creating a state of mind that matches the task of creative writing. And that's something that we need to know and need to listen for in clients is what state works best for what task and how to help them match that. A state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and how we respond. Each of us has a range of state with some awareness of what state works best for which endeavor, even how to enter and exit different states. It's very important to become aware of which state to enter for example, a creative endeavor, which state to enter for conceptual planning, or what works best for everything from the alertness of business endeavors to relaxation for sleep. So, before we talk more about how to do this, let me give you a case vignette of something that happened recently in my practice. Just to give you an idea of how it can be used. Now, each of you, I hope, have downloaded the outline and the single page of the neuroconditioning worksheet with four columns. If you haven't, if you can, without distraction, go ahead and download that, especially the worksheet, because I'm going to refer to that, because I developed that in conjunction with this client fairly recently. My client, I'll call Jim. He was the COO of a large healthcare company in a major U.S. city when we first started working together. As a result of our work together for a few months, he decided to toss his hat in the ring for a CEO position. He had some great offers. We crafted a terrific compensation package. So as soon as Jim began his new position as CEO, he entered an arena where there was already a merger Tom gets on his soapbox and explains simple things to me, like he would to a novice, I overreact. I want to tell him off. It's like a put down. And I said, I understand it bruises your pride when you take it personally. He said, I know I have to think and not react, but I get sucked in even when I know what not to do. He just sets me off in the way he talks down to me, like he knows it all. I can't not respond. I need a strategy. So Jim recognized that this reactive mode departed a state of mind where he could reason and negotiate strategically. I asked, what ideally would you like to do? He said, well, I have to think and not react. I have to let him finish his points and get the emotion out of it for me. He was saying, in effect, that he needed to regulate his state of mind and manage his emotions in order to be effective. How to do that in this situation? When someone's in an emotional state, they're marooned in their right brain, the feeling intuitive brain. The emotional brain can even hijack the intellectual logical brain and hold it hostage. So what do? Your brain is working against you. Jim and I then collaborated on a strategy to use his emotion as a signal to plan action rather than to react. So here's, in a brief synopsis, the principles that we discussed during the session. First, don't take it personally. The principle, everyone is always making self-statements. Tom was showing Jim exactly what it was like to be him. When I asked Jim how he understood Tom responding in the way he did, Jim could reflect. He probably feels threatened or insecure at the time he gets on his soapbox and lectures. Jim recognized he was taking personally the behavior that was really Tom's counter to his own discomfort. So in looking at it this way, he achieved a great deal more information about Tom, so this helped him in his position. Proactively recognize emotional triggers and response patterns to get centered and to substitute an ideal response. Look at the four-column approach. And I would ask someone usually to create a brainstorming time for themselves, maybe 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes where they're uninterrupted. Put down in the left column all the emotional cues or triggers that would set them off. And in the second column, their usual response, their reactive response, what they would do when they instantly are cued to change their state of mind and move into that reactive mode because they're immersed in that state of mind. Then the third column is a way to get centered and grounded, to use a way of getting centered and grounded. We're going to talk about that in a minute, especially focus and physiology, and how to create a mantra to do that, to get instantly grounded and centered. And then to plan at a time when there's no pressure, no stress, an ideal response. So the idea of the first two columns is to cue the radar to be aware of what usually triggers an unusual response, and that state of mind then to get centered. The third column, to move to a state of mind it contains the ideal response. Now, here's the principle. You cannot go from column 2 to column 4. You cannot go from an altered state to another state, no matter how good or ideal that state is. It's a two-step process. You have to get centered and grounded first. You have to go back to that search engine capacity before you can boot up another software program or have access to all of your software. So, by reining in his natural emotional responses, I also recommended, in addition to his chart, that Jim take notes while Tom was talking. This actually kept him from verbally reacting, and Tom thought it was great because he's writing down everything he said. And he could plan what he wanted to say. He could write it out. Then he could plan the strategy of response. He could review what he will say to make it objective and reasoned, in other words, restore left brain logic. Finally, he could make his points or statement when Tom finished speaking. So when Jim stayed in the logical part of his brain, that balance of right and left brain, he did great. Jim's regulation of his state of mind allowed him to sustain effectiveness rather than be emotionally derailed. His conclusion, I think I understand him and me better. I'm going to have an easier time of it in the future when I encounter guys like him. And the result was a world-class merger of those two companies that had a powerful let's talk about access to mind states in some practical ways. The regulation of feeling and states of mind involves the understanding and mastery of access to particular states of mind without altering consciousness. In other words, staying present. Let me give you some examples. Probably nowhere is this more poignant than the regulation of mind state than with artists and writers to enter a creative state. And these are some kind of extreme examples that will give you an idea of what you may do in a more ordinary way. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to enter the genre of mind to write her macabre literature. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and Diane Ackerman, one of my favorite nonfiction writers, wrote on a plank, a pine plank, across a bathtub with warm bath water and a bubble bath, kind of that floaty process that creates the creative thinking. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm so he could come back and recreate his experience on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repeatedly during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house their evolving story. So the corresponding state of mind of the reader then often matches with that of the author, because the author guides the reader to a particular state through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of the imagery, the rhythm of feelings. The most natural way of regulating state change is distraction, such as jangling car keys to shift a crying infant to a calmer state. And I've worked with someone recently, I don't have time to go into it, but whenever he would engage in this way of regulating a state of mind by distraction, by continuing to do that, he was derailing his process as a writer to continue to use that old method of regulating a state of mind. And we each have various ways to reconnect mind and body, like getting grounded in physical activity, a walk outdoors, a warm bath, a shower, breathing exercises. And we're going to discuss how to do this with clients in just a moment. A mentoring application I want to talk about right now. It's important for the mentor coach to enter into and hold the mind-body state of the client to understand the subjective experience as well as the story communicated by the client. Now, bear with me here for a minute. Developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally before the verbal linguistics of the left brain mature. Now, what this means is that most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness. There are right brain communication of emotional states of coaching client. Intuitive blinks, social and emotional awareness. I would recommend the book, if you haven't seen it already, by Malcolm Gladwell called Blink. It's about the use of intuition. So the mentor coach needs to remain open to receiving communication from the client to become attuned to the state of mind of the client. This precedes synthesizing and planning. If anyone's joined late, there's a bit of noise. If you would mute *6, and I'll come back in just a few minutes for a discussion time. So once we're tuned into the client, we can receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just book. There's my British colleague. Together, we can then explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, and plan. This resonance can also creatively transform the experience into new ideas, co-creations, beyond where either might go alone. So we have to allow this right brain engagement with the client in order to take in emotional communication, to hold unexplained experiences, feelings, and ideas until a recognizable pattern emerges. This requires deep listening and attention simultaneously at multiple levels. It's a way of thinking and a way of experiencing combined. It's the art and science of mentor coaching. So let's do an everyday application and then break for a minute for questions. regardless of how logical you think you are, your first register of a new stimulus is emotional. And that's for all of us. Any new input goes directly to the amygdala in the midbrain, and then to the hippocampus, still in the midbrain, that attaches meaning. Then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually, to make logical sense. Now, a footnote here, the hippocampus is the location of the unconscious. It's where meanings are attached. Everything at the midbrain, the reptilian brain, is an unconscious process. So, notice that emotional activation need a mute, please. If someone's joined late, please mute star 6. The emotional activation registers before cognitive areas of the brain come into play to even assess options. In fact, neuroscientists demonstrate that we make decisions, especially buy or purchase decisions, up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware of it. Once we unconsciously make an emotional commitment to a yes or no, these lower brain structures send the conscious mind on a mission to gather all the logical reasons to support that decision. This rationalization is confirmation bias. Some neuroscientists said that the primary purpose of the forebrain is to find reasons to make the decision that we've already made in the midbrain make sense, to have a light on something that's sensible. So when we make a choice, we couple memory and wisdom from past experiences with the best guesses of a likely future. Now, the part of the brain that anticipates pleasant outcomes, the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center activates a buy decision. So making money or spending money or anticipating spending money activates the pleasure center. Now, consider this. A don't buy decision originates in the insula, an area involved in anticipating pain. That's the part of the brain that gets activated when we give up money or when we pay bills. So this can drive decision-making. Consider this. Credit cards decouple buying, the activation of the pleasure center, and paying, the activation of the pain center. The pleasure of the purchase is segmented from the pain of future payment. This may be why people spend 23% more when they buy with a credit card than they buy with cash or check. This segmentation renders repayment, or actual payment, a future abstraction. Our optimism bias even suggests, well, I'm going to have more money next month, and at least my dear self, tomorrow's another day. So this is something to consider in terms of how our minds and brains work. So one application here, it's hard to save for the future, especially for retirement, because the way our minds work and our brains are wired, it's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying. It's a hit of dopamine, the same chemical that is the reaction of coke, the same chemical that cocaine cues. It's hard to resist that immediate pleasure because making and spending money activate the pleasure center in the brain, mediated by dopamine. So it's difficult to substitute a theory like a future need, long-term saving, or retirement for the immediate. Now, there's been some studies that show that the more you can imagine your future self, can envision your future self, the more you'll save for the future. One study, and that's Emily Cronin out of Cambridge, some studies out of Stanford indicate that they do computer-enhanced aging processes for everything from retirement savings, and when people are see computer-enhanced images themselves, they begin to save 2 to 3 times as much. Same with smoking if they continue versus if they don't, if they diet and lose weight versus if they don't. There's also a blog I want to refer you to in my archives, mentorpath.com, and blog. You'll see the tab at the top. It's archived. It's called 14 Ways to Outsmart Your Brain to Spend Less. Now, I want to pause and see if there are questions or comments and things that you'd like to talk about briefly before we move on to how to regulate states of mind and some practical aspects of how to do that. I'm interested in your thoughts or questions. And even if is this making sense so far? Anyone? Star 6 to unmute to comp. Lisa, I think I've rendered everyone speechless.
This is Debbie. The blog article that you referred to, is that on the Coach Training Alliance website?
No, it's on my website, mentorpath.com, and at the top of the homepage you'll see a tab for blog, and when you go there it's in the blog archives. Lisa, if you will send me an email for the people who participate, there are a couple of things I thought of as I'm going along here that I'd like to send them in addition to the two downloads. So if that's a possibility, if you can sort out those emails, I'll be happy to send some additional material. Any other questions?
Dave, if you'd like to send those to me, I can post them on your page so when they get the recording, they can also download them there.
Okay, that sounds good. Great.
That's great. So, okay.
Other questions?
This is Sonia, I want to say that it absolutely is making sense. But before you said it with your friend, it was the CEO having a problem with the other guy. I said, don't take it personally. It's myself. That's because I had to do that once a couple of years ago with a boss that would just drive me up a wall. And I could sit there and smile as long as I kept saying to myself, don't take it personal. And it really works.
And that's a huge principle in our human interactions, that everyone can only make self-statements. And we each can only make self-statements. I can't tell you what you think or what you feel or who you are or what you're about. I can only make a self-statement. And what I say about you tells you more about me. Now, this works for clients, too, to not take it personally. One of the principal cardinal aspects of working with clients is to not take it personally. Now, that doesn't mean we don't listen to a client in terms of if they make comments about us or have personal comments or criticism or of the work, that we take that as information, but we don't take it personally, because this leads to one of the central aspects of working with a client, that a client is always doing the very best job possible of showing us exactly what it's like to be him or her. And if we take it in that way, we hear it as their self-statement, not as personally. We put our ego in a blind trust. And that allows us to listen to the client, because whatever they bring, whatever the issues are they have, they may tell you and make it easy and talk about certain content. But where we really earn our money is where they recreate it in the process. You know, consider the CEO who's alienated every person in that board of directors, every person in the executive suite, and that person is urged to get coaching. Now, guess what? That person begins to annoy and alienate you. Now, this is where you earn your money, because you've established, hopefully, a working alliance where you and that person can talk about it and look at the dynamics of the interaction, the behavior pattern, the attachment pattern. That is the way their mind and brain works, that comes alive in the relationship with you so that you have access to it. And that's the very best hope that person has of anyone in the world, to look at and address aspects that need to be understood and changed. And when you have a systematic way to address that understanding and change, all the better. Yeah, so thanks for that comment, Sonia. Anyone else?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I sure can.
Yeah, this is Gloria. I was in a class. Hi, I've been in all of your classes. I was here in your class last year, and I did use this neural conditioning to make changes, and I just want to make sure I used it quick. I used it correctly. So my client would come home from work, and they had a list. They were remodeling the house. There was a list of things he was supposed to do, and she would come home and just blow up because he hadn't done these things on the list. So I told her, use this. Take a breath, go to your room, sit down, get your journal out, and put down the trigger, and then the usual way that you would respond with him, which is with usually screaming at him and signing things. And then begin to breathe in and regulate how you could handle this differently. And she did, and she changed her behavior and went in and handled it and did it two or three times, and it worked. So is that how you would use it?
Absolutely. So let's look at that and expand that a little bit. When she comes home and she tells you about blowing up and about repetitively doing that,
right,
the first thing that I might suggest is to say, I can understand your frustration with not having done what you've hoped. So that you've resonated empathically with someone, that's going to regulate her state of mind, because she's likely partway to that upset already and recounting it with you. So she needs that empathic resonance to help her regulate her state of mind that instant. What that means is that you've created a common ground of understanding. Because look at what happens when you don't do that, when someone does do that. Someone, you know, says something that's been upsetting, and the other person is kind of waiting for them to finish. They say what they want to say, or look at some strategy, and soon enough, it escalates. Because the first person does not feel heard, and they'll say what they said a little bit louder, as if louder would work. You know, kind of like for somebody who doesn't understand English, you say it in louder English. Like louder English is going to work than the original English did. So it's going to escalate in that way. So the first response is an empathic resonance. The second response may be simply to ask, is your system working? So now you have an empathic connection. You have a collaborator. So then you can move to the story and the strategy. So this is the principle here. State always comes first. Then story and then strategy. Often we engage with a client by moving immediately into the strategy. That's what we're trained to do. State always comes first, because state determines how something is going to be processed. Your state of mind determines the meaning that you attach to something, and the meaning you attach to something determines your behavior. Think about how in two different states of mind, you respond to the same stimulus in radically different ways. State of mind determines that. So that's a great example, and yours worked, so I bet you did this. You just did something like that. That's just a way to deconstruct that and look at the steps involved. So
yeah, I understand you have disappointments with some of your things your husband does, but also understand and see that, you know, what is, and she'll say, is that working? And, of course, not. And so now we have to create a strategy that will work. And not only did it work for her to calm her down, but he started being more conscious about the things that he had promised. So only was she shifted.
She created a collaboration with him as well. Uh-huh. So you'll recognize that little question I ran in from my colleague, Dr. Phil, how is that working for you? That's a consideration too.
Exactly.
Okay, let me move on with some more material and we'll break again in just a bit. So I want to talk about, and back to Star 6 for you, how to regulate states of mind, which we've already begun talking about. The most important thing we can do to achieve success is to manage our emotions and regulate our states of mind. And you heard me say that once or twice. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind. They didn't need a coach to succeed. They needed a coach to sustain their success. Using drugs, alcohol, or some addictive substance or process to regulate state of mind and manage emotion can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, as I've mentioned, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. Since the state of mind determines the meaning we attach and meaning determines behavior, by changing a state of mind, we change the behavior. So, there are two primary ways to regulate your state of mind. One is physiology, the other is focus. And physiology is how you use your body. your biochemistry to change your state of mind. Relaxation, deep breathing, meditation are examples. Focus. What and how you focus on. From quantum physics and the brain, you get what you focus on, not what you want. Focus aligns your energy field. What you focus on, what you pay attention to, determines your state of mind. And then your state of mind determines the meaning you attach to something. Your power is in what you focus on. The questions we ask ourselves determine what we focus on. And think about how we're always asking ourselves questions without even being consciously aware of that process of asking. Two questions we're always asking is, what does this mean? What should I do? If you have an habitual feeling you don't like, or a mood or a state that you don't like, it can come from a repeated focus and repeated questions. Why is this always happening to me? The presupposition is that you're in a past position and affected. Why am I overweight? The focus is on overweight. The quality of your life comes down to the quality of the questions you ask daily. Change the questions. Ask a better question. You're always asking questions from the moment you wake up, even though you're not consciously aware of them usually when you wake up. If you immediately begin asking, what's going to go wrong today? You've already begun a scenario that establishes a state of mind. You know, another bad question. Can I really do this? So, ask better questions. What will I create today that will be more powerful than I ever dreamed of? And have fun doing it. Your brain follows your focus, whether that's positive or negative. Ask empowering questions. Instead of, why am I overweight? What can I start to do today for better nutrition and physical shape? Asking effective questions determines your state of mind. This is your power of focus. The best mentors, leaders, and teachers are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our own resources. Here's an example of a better question. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. They could ask, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people wanted to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but he asked, do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? And one more. Listen to how Steve Jobs convinced former Pepsi president John Sculley to become CEO at Apple. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, and Jobs simply asked Sculley, do you want to sell sugared water all your life, or do you want to change the world? So, here's an exercise. It's an exercise that I've given a couple of clients who would wake up each day and have, they were going through such a stressful time that their day was determined from the instant they woke up. And I asked them to do this. Write down three questions that put you in a peak state, three empowering questions. And for them, I asked them to write them down before they went to bed, have them at their bedside table, so as soon as they turn on their lamp, before they even fully woke up, if they would answer those questions, the empowering questions, because that locked in a state of mind. You know, think about, like, someday when you get up, you stub your toe, and, you know, you're in a bad, it's a bad day already. So those empowering questions can really put you in a state of mind that can be useful. Remember, you're already asking questions. This just changes the focus to constantly and continuously, actually just consciously, engineer the questions that empower you. So now let's look at how we can combine physiology and focus, the two things that regulate state of mind, with a cue to do this and compress it down to about 2 or 3 seconds. We're going to talk about mantras. Here's a story about mantras. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th out of 217 in their division in free throw shooting. Now, he couldn't go anywhere but up, so he's got nothing to do. During practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. He would have them do a cue, like dribble the basketball twice, but he emphasized to each of them, what you do for your cue and what you do for your phrase needs to be yours. It has to be uniquely yours, but he gave examples. So bouncing the basketball twice and repeating a phrase like relaxed and smooth. any tension and then taking the shot. Now, in addition, he simulated game conditions by abruptly stopping a player in practice and asking to shoot two free throws. Now, when you think about it, this is exactly what happens in a game. You have all the pressure of the game, and then suddenly you stop and shoot free throws. You don't line up and shoot 30 free throws and get to count the best ones like you do in practice. You do it in games. So he simulated the game condition. So he simulated the mindset of pressure in a game situation by suddenly stopping them to shoot a free throw. If they made a shot, they got to take a breather, like for a home team, they get applause. If he missed, had to sprint around the court four times. Like, again, home court, the Blues are being away the simulation of the applause because he missed. In 2 years, the team was ranked number one in their division nationwide, number one out of 217. So here are the three parts to a mantra, a cue, two dribbles, some kind of personal gesture, a phrase like relaxed and powerful, and a deep breath, breathe in relaxation, breathe out tension. Mine, since you ask, before I do a keynote, I put my index finger and my thumb of both hands together to form two little circles, two little fraternity circles, and my phrase is relaxed and powerful, and I have a deep breath in and out. So in about 2 seconds, I'm ready to go. Now, mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers that can instantly change a state of mind. Some of my clients who are pro athletes and actors have used it to get grounded and centered for their performance. And pro athletes especially are very conscious of managing states. And remember that some people are not verbal, not auditory. Some are visual. For example, an actress who was very visual would envision, instead of the phrase, an auditory phrase that she would say, she would envision herself enveloped in a white, warm light, totally enveloped in that before she would walk on stage or before a camera or before a guest on a talk show. And so remember to stay with your client's styles. Mantras can both calm as well as keep you from overthinking in high-pressure situations. So let's talk about neural conditioning and then break for discussion. What we associate to a stimulus is what determines our behavior. To change your behavior, change your neural association. Thinking positively is not enough. You can think positively for a minute, but then go back to what already has been established in your brain and the neuronal networks and connections. It would be the same effects as trying to change a software program by booting it up and talking positively to your computer. And one of the great philosophers of the 21st century said, everybody's got a plan until he gets punched in the mouth. That was Mike Tyson. The stimulus is there in your brain, even if you don't believe it or know it's there. It's linked. Winston tastes good. What's your association? For 80% of people, it's like a cigarette should. Even if you don't smoke, even if you have a strong belief linking smoking and cancer, even if it's been 30 years since you last heard that jingle, what you link inside your head, the meaning you give, determines your behavior. You can change your behavior when you change the meaning. That's what that four calm approach is about, to regulate your state of mind so you can attach the meaning, the ideal state and behavior, that four calm, exactly how you want it to be. You reprogram your associations and rewire your brain. Reprogramming neural conditioning is a process. It's not an end. You have to work it for a while, several weeks, until it becomes automatic. Now, a neural association can get linked or anchored by coupling a strong emotion to whatever's happening around you. This creates a link. Anchors happen when you're in a highly emotional state. And now, here's a consideration. There are two forces behind all human behavior. The need to avoid pain, the desire to bring pleasure, to gain pleasure. To understand the motivating forces of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biological. The brain fights against change to avoid pain on a biological basis. Trying to create success by creating more pain unless achieving that success basically doesn't work. So, in any moment, the pleasure of eating may feel greater than the pain of overweight. The immediate pleasure of the cheesecake is more enjoyable than the pain of the idea of being fat, especially if you have strawberry topping. Overweight is an abstract idea, not at the same level of sensory reality as an immediate pleasure. Spending money in this moment, a greater pleasure than the later gain by saving or the later pain of avoiding debt financially and emotionally. So anytime anybody doesn't do something, they procrastinate, they decide on a goal and don't do it, there's something about what pain are they avoiding. So one of the questions that you might have, if somebody doesn't do something, what's the pain they're associating? And how can you associate a better question, a better pleasure later on, even though it's not as immediate? So to change your behavior, you have to change what you link to pleasure and what you link to pain. And the need to avoid pain is usually greater than the need for pleasure. This drives a lot of human behavior. To influence someone, find out what you're already influenced by, what they link pain and pleasure to. And again, if you're not doing something you want or need to do, even that you've committed to do, you link more pain with doing it than not doing it. If you don't have enough money or money that you want, somewhere in your unconscious mind, you link greater pain to having it. With a lack of abundance, even though this doesn't make sense consciously, with a lack of abundance financially, unconsciously, you may think that money equals pain. For example, and these are some of the shadow stories here to go along with the surface story of I want more money. All this effort, I think I'll just be as comfortable where I am. Or I'd have to take advantage of people. Or having more money means being unspiritual. People will judge me and I'll be ostracized. I'm going to be all alone at the top. If you're sabotaging any success in any area of your life, look at the approach, wanting pleasure, and the avoidance, having fear. Now, the usual focus is, what will be the pain if I do this? So think about a better question. The need for focus is, what will be the pain if you don't follow through? What will be the cost and pain if you don't do it? So we are defined by the stories we tell ourselves. If your story is empowering you, that's great. If it's causing you to fall short, then it needs to be examined. Is your story a limiting story in any area of your life? The one you pick will be the one you believe and live. Most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves, the one that came from 10 years ago or the one they want to believe. Your story contains the patterns that shape your behavior. So here's the final question, and I'll wrap up in just a moment. What's the biggest addiction that we have? The biggest addiction. The thing almost impossible to give up or to abstain from. The pattern sequence that gives us an effective focus and actually allows us to escape our own fear. Our biggest addiction is our problems. Now, to reiterate for just a moment, for any situation, there are three components: state, story, and strategy. State management is the most important aspect and the first. Choose the mindset that matches a successful outcome. Story is the organizer of what you do, the theme and storylines you're pursuing. For Martin Luther King, his story was, I have a dream. Strategy is to move benefits to behavior for successful performance. Most people start with strategy, especially in coaching, but strategy is an involved part of the process, not the beginning. Reevaluation of your approach, your state of mind, is a key element. In neural conditioning, state comes first, then behavior. So how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? Three key principles and some questions that are associated with them that I want to close with and then a brief story. One, identify what, and these are in your outline, identify what to change. You need to get to the point where you feel something must change now, and that you are going to do it. Must, can, and will change it. So here are some questions to ask for this first part. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequence? This is a variation of the Uncle Phil question. How's that working for you? What's the pain associated to a current choice that's now adaptive? and what will give you pleasure with changing. To interrupt the existing pattern. Recognize the cues for behavior so you can interrupt it immediately before calm approach. A pattern must be interrupted to change neural conditioning and create a different mindset. Couple of questions. What are the cues or triggers for your automatic pattern? Think of ways to interrupt the pattern once you've identified it. Planning out all four of those columns on the four-column approach, I believe, will be helpful there. Three, create a new association that empowers you. Think of all the things you gain, the pleasure you're going to have from the change. Condition a new empowering association to the present cue. For example, if you're phobic about something, link feeling strong and powerful with that stimulus. When you feel and behave differently, the problem dissolves by creating a new story. It's kind of like your back when you get up to walk. Here are a couple of questions for step three. What's the new association to the familiar cue or trigger? What's the change you will bring about? And then think of all the things you gain and all the pleasure you have with the change. I want to tell one quick story, and we're open for questions and discussion. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp before World War II. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp where death was certain. It was imminent. Instead of just giving up and accepting his inevitable fate of death, he observed that about 1 out of 25 of his fellow prisoners somehow managed to survive. He set about studying the characteristics of those who survived. He found that it was what the survivors associated to that made the difference to help them survive, their neural association. While 24 out of every 25 of the ones who died focused on the instant death that was inevitable for them, the people who survived developed a reason to survive, a focus, a created meaning for their suffering, rather than accepting their fate, wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, they constructed a reason for surviving so that they could tell their story to their children to make certain that this kind of suffering would never happen again. It changed the meaning of their suffering to something that would make a difference, to substitute an ultimate pleasure of purpose to transcend the immediate pain of their suffering. They were able to make it through and had a will to live that pulled them through the very toughest of times. Okay, I'm interested in your questions, clarifications, things that would be helpful to talk about. What do you think about what we've talked about so far? Yes, please.
Can you just reiterate the three steps of the mantra? I got lost somewhere in there.
To cue the mantra, like my little finger and thumb thing to bounce the basketball. One client stepped on an elevator in her corporate headquarters and had to ride the elevator several times a day. There was a stimulus on that elevator that cued a very negative association, put her in a terrible mood. So what she did when she walked on the elevator was to take her right hand, put it on her left shoulder, and do the remainder. That was her cue. And what she did, the remainder of her mantra, was to focus, to ask herself an empowering question, and to breathe in and out. She had a phrase that she focused on, rather than a question, actually, and then had a deep breathing once in and out, and she was set to go. It did not have the same effect. So the cue and the focus and the physiology, the empowering phrase or question, and the deep breathing.
Great. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
This is Stephanie. I have a question. I have a client who's a C-level manager. He's an engineer, and we talk a lot about mantras. And because he's so proof-oriented and scientifically oriented, I was wondering if there was any blog written on mantras that I could support what I'm saying. I'm teaching him.
I had a little trouble hearing you because he's group-oriented.
Because he's an engineer, he's scientifically motivated and interested and wants proof behind the pudding, so to speak, that mantras really do work. So I was wondering if there's any documentation on it that I can send to him as a resource.
For those who believe Let me say it differently. For those who believe no proof is necessary, for those who do not, no proof is sufficient.
Got it.
Now, I would suggest that he try it with an open mind. I prefer him, I'll send you a link to the blog where I have this this study that I just mentioned, or this, not the study, but the University of Utah. There's anecdotal evidence. I don't know of scientific evidence, but if he's interested in keeping an open mind, and he must be interested to pay you money for coaching him, then you might do an experiment with him and see if it works. And ask him to stay open about it and see if it works and see what works the best with him. So I don't know any empirical studies, but I'll keep that in mind, though.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone else? We'll stay out 2 or 3 minutes.
Dave, this is Imra. Thank you. You're brilliant.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Wonderful to hear you speak. And just so happens that I'm working with a young man right now that this is so appropriate for. And he has discovered that he gets into not viciously violent anger yet, but he's had 2 incidents over a 6-year period where, when he's under incredible stress, he just can lash out and do things that he cannot believe he did afterwards. How do you help someone like that who's obviously not that aware of those pressure points and have the pre-build-up, I guess, help him to discover what goes on in his life, that at what point he's going to have that kind of pressure? What would you add?
Okay, well, great question, and I think it's very necessary, and he already is aware to be working with you and presenting with you, so there are huge aspects. And I always emphasize and validate what someone has done to get to this point and how much work and growth they've done to do that, because that is huge. And I think that builds on the validation that they then internalize in a self-validating way, in a self-regulatory way, because this is what you ultimately hope. So often, when somebody begins with focusing on a problem, we immediately jump in and look at what's the matter, rather than validating that, you know, to know to ask is half the answer. I think it's really terrific that you are aware enough to recognize this and to objectify it enough, and you've already shown tremendous growth to be able to do that. Now, let's look together at how to strategize around that. So what I would do with him, I would use that four-column approach, because he needs especially to identify the cues and triggers. Now, there may be more than one, or there may be a kind of crescendo of triggers for him to get in a really out-of-control state, and I would probably focus more with him on expanding that first column, the cues or triggers. Is there a cue? Does it follow another? Does it build up? What happens? What's the sequence? To look at the cues and then his usual response, because I'll bet that there are many versions of this all-or-nothing response. But if you just take the all-or-nothing, there are certain cues or triggers that he had that may build on themselves to get to that second column, which is the two significant entities. So what you mentioned as the incredible stress, these are all state-changing experiences. And I would spend specific time looking at the stressors, because it's not what happens to us, it's how we interpret what happens to us. He's using some incidents that in his neural conditioning result in stress. He needs to reprogram at that level to change the meaning of things and to ask better questions when he sees something that's stressful, rather than going into the state-changing scenario to regulate the state of mind, and to do that by focus and physiology of asking, what are the benefits? What can I learn from this? How can I create a better situation than seeing this as just one step on a downhill slope that inevitably means he's going to have stress with it? So I would look at changing the meaning and the interpretation every step of the way. This is one of the best things we can possibly do in coaching. Now, does that make sense for your guy?
It does. Sorry, it was a bit of noise. Can you just give me the column two again?
Column two is the usual response. The trigger leading to the is the reaction. And the reaction is behavior, but it's also state of mind. This is somebody's cued to enter a state of mind, and that's usually identified by the behavior. So that column two is not only the usual response to behavior, the reaction, it's the state of mind. And then column four is based on the grounded state of mind and is the proactive. It's the plan, something that somebody can do to strike while the iron's cold, to pre-plan how a certain stimulus is going to lead to ideal behavior rather than down the slippery slope of what has happened so far. I know we're out of time. Thank you all so much. I really appreciate your attendance and energy and your questions. I hope this has been helpful to you. Lisa, thanks very much for moderating this. I appreciate it. It's great to have you as always and to collaborate with you. And thanks for all the work you've done to put this whole symposium together. Everything that you're seeing unfold in these next 2.5 days, the symposium, was the launch and the baby of Lisa, and we thank her for all of this. So thanks very much, Lisa.
Well, thank you, Dave. It was awesome. What a great class. I'm looking forward to hearing more from you in the symposium. And thanks, everyone, for joining in.
Thanks very, very much.